Hey guys, taxation is theft. We have Representative Brandon Finney with us today. Say hi, Brandon.
Hey, how are you guys?
So, Brandon's kind of an interesting story because he's, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're an elected libertarian to a pretty high position compared to what most libertarians actually get elected to.
Yes, and I had the pleasure of actually switching parties and making it a public thing.
So you're a libertarian now, but when you originally ran and when you were elected, which party were you running for?
I ran under the Republican Party. That was the only party other than the Democrats that had ballot access. So I really didn't have too much of a choice at that time. So. And just as a point of clarification, in case anyone asks when they see the video, that is my that's my kid's bed. We share my office together, so in case anybody gets confused, I have a small apartment, so that's kind of where she hangs out when I have her, on the weekends and stuff. So, but just put I've done a live video in the past, and like, what is in there? What is that? That's just my daughter Emma, that's her bed. So I ran in 2016 as a Republican and I got elected in my first try, so that was pretty cool.
Awesome. Sorry, can you hold on 1 second? I'm just having a technical issue here.
Sure.
So, sorry about that. We're always running into technical issues because sure. I'm basically running the show from Mexico, and it's really interesting putting everything together. And I'm always talking about the differences between the U.S. and Mexico as part of the show. And obviously, some of these technical issues are part of that. But so this is really interesting because you. A lot of people complain about libertarians, like if a libertarian goes to a different party, they run as a Democrat or they run as a Republican, a lot of the libertarians get pissed off and they say, you're not a real libertarian. And here we have you kind of coming from another party. Now, do you ever get any pushback from libertarians saying you're not libertarian enough? Have you had that? Have you talked to anyone in the party for long enough for that type of thing to start happening? Or are they welcoming? What's your overall feeling with that?
It's been an overall positive experience. I think if we can set aside a lot of the Facebook stuff and all the online, squabbles and look at to see how everything kind of gels in person. I've been to a ton of state conventions that I've been asked to speak at. I met a lot of great people and that's what I value the most is when you get to meet people in person and talk to them about your experiences and like the things that you're trying to do while in office or as an activist instead of the online stuff. I think that's what, makes, that's where it finds its value. As far as the pushback is concerned, people have to understand that you have to start somewhere. And when I was campaigning for office, I was coming from I had gotten back from a deployment 6 months earlier, and I was kind of following some of the things that were happening back home, and I wasn't really a fan of what my state government was up to and what kind of things that they were doing to spend money and institute new policies and programs I didn't really agree with. So I wanted to run for office because instead of, complaining about the things I didn't like, I wanted to be a part of the solution in New Hampshire. So I ran for office, and I got connected to people pretty quickly. They needed a candidate for my seat because the person that was in it for a long time was stepping down. She was done with politics and they needed someone to kind of take her place. And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. So that was pretty easy. But at the time, like I actually wanted to run as independent, to be honest with you. But the city clerk kind of told me like, well, There's a long process to getting on a ballot. You need, you know, thousands of signatures and a lot of money. And I was like, oh, geez, like, I don't want to kind of go through all that, because I didn't, you know, I didn't really know a lot of the you know, political process as far as becoming a candidate and then getting elected. So I just picked the party I had the most agreement with. And I never said I was a conservative. I've always had, you know, kind of our philosophy as you know, as the underlying, you know, political foundation that I started with, you know, and I kind of grew up in the Ron Paul era. A lot of us did. So that's, you know, I'm 30, so I'm young enough to remember being able to vote for him in the primaries and stuff. So that's kind of what I took when I went to people's doors and said, look, like, I don't want more government. I want to, you know, scale back a lot of what we're doing in the state, even. And you know, compared to other states, even in New England, like, we're actually pretty awesome. But there are a lot of things that we can still work on and fix. And you know, the marijuana is a long, frustrating struggle to get that passed. And we finally got decriminalization passed last year, so that's in effect. But you know, getting it fully legalized has been a battle, and I've co-sponsored bills on the issue, trying to get it to where it needs to be. And it always passes in the House, but once it gets beyond that, that's where it's kind of a dead issue. We don't have a very effective Senate, and I actually don't like, a big portion of our Senate in New Hampshire, you know, because they think that they're, you know, the grown adults in the room, and then, you know, the rest of us in the House are our kids, and so we don't really know better, you know. It's really dumb. So yeah. they kill a lot of good bills, and they've killed my bills, even though they really had no impact on current reality, I guess you could say. So I know I'm kind of getting off the weeds here, so but when I got elected and I got to the House, I kind of seen pretty quickly the issues with being in the GOP in New Hampshire. There was kind of that faction of libertarians in the, in that party that, kind of make up, a pretty big chunk of their caucus. And I was seeing kind of how the leadership on the floor, and like in the state party and stuff, was kind of ostracizing that group of, of people in the Republican Party, because they want them all to kind of, fall in line and, toe the line. And that's kind of how those authoritarian parties work. They want people to fall in line and, do what they're told. And when people don't adhere to that, they get kind of pushed away. And so, but that happened to be a large faction of their caucus that wanted, to scale back a lot of the spending, and they want to maximize personal freedom. And they were just getting a lot of pushback from leadership. So I saw that pretty quickly, and I saw it in Caleb, because we met pretty soon after I became a candidate, and then he helped me out with some stuff on social media, and then we've been friends ever since. So he was the first one to switch, because he was, getting bullied pretty hard by even the Speaker of the House, because they're from the same area. So, and I witnessed it, like, in front of me happening, and I just got really angry about it. So coupled with how the party kind of treats its own people, and then with, the first, Republican governor that we've had in the state in like a decade, passing a massive spending bill. The budget spent like $600 million more than the last two administrations. So it was like really crazy to see that happening from a so-called fiscally conservative party. And that was kind of the, tipping off point for me to being like, this isn't where I want to be. I didn't get elected to take and spend, people's money at this exorbitant rate. And I had a meeting with the governor, and I told him, I had a meeting with him last May, so it's been a year now. And I kind of told him that I can't support this anymore, and I can't be a part of a party that isn't adhering to its own platform, and it like is kind of compromising my principles. So he was the first one to know. And then I made it public at the end of June, and here we are. So
So that's all really interesting. And what I really want to know is, like, because you sound like a normal person. You sound like a lot of the libertarians. You don't sound like one of these career politicians who we normally find in the Democrat and Republican parties. So
no, far from that.
Yeah. So which is great, but at the same time, like, it sounds like you were able to win and win that election really easily, whereas most libertarians who are just like you, like, we can never get, like, you know, it's, if we get 5 or 10% of the vote, it's like shocking. Did you get any help from the party when you were running the first time, or did you did they help you out? Was it mostly just because you had the R next to your name? What do you think it was?
I had some people help me in the beginning. But it was mostly the county affiliate that did a lot of that. It wasn't the state party at all. I actually had somebody that I'm still friendly with today that I still talk to, that helped me out with some, some yard signs, and that was the biggest, thing. But I honestly did almost everything alone. I kind of paid for all of my own stuff, and I went out on the streets, and I knocked all the doors I needed to kind of by myself, and I spent the entire summer, and you can see right here, my wall is my org map. Like, all that stuff in purple up there is mine, and stuff in the, in the yellow here is mine. And I did all of that by myself. It was a lot of work. I didn't get to a lot of the stuff I wanted to that year, but I think it was a great, time to experience how to go about campaigning. But as far as help from the party, no, there are so many people that run for office in this state. I mean, we have 400 people or up to 400 people in the state house, and they can't help everybody. There's not enough, time and money and people to do that. So I didn't expect it. But I had people I became, friendly with, and I gotten involved with some organizations that, I did like their surveys and stuff, and they did endorsements or, whatever. And that was the only time I had ever talked to the NRA. I won't ever do that again, because I don't want anything to do with the NRA, but for, political purposes, it was a good move to make, and I wouldn't, go back on that. I would do it again if I had to back then. But now, my philosophies and my views on politics in general have changed so dramatically, even since being in the party now. And it's been kind of an eye-opening experience in seeing how much the LPNH wants to help candidates. I really appreciate that part. The other two parties spend a lot of time trying to, we kind of do it too, but they're a little more like jackbooted about it, as far as like we have to vet all of our candidates and for some of the seats, not for every seat, pardon me. But in most cases in this state, because there are so many people that have to file for office, like, they just want somebody with an R or somebody with a D to just put a name on the ballot, because they need somebody for that seat. So, but what's unique about our position is that, like, every candidate from the Libertarian Party, in this state, they get the full, like, backing of the party. They get plenty of, people to help spread the message. And I'm still pretty small. We're a pretty strong party, but we're tiny compared to a lot of other states. So, but we have a really good way of providing a unified front. So that's been a nice change for me.
What do you think? Well, there's another question I want to get to, but first I want to know what. Sure. What kind of, you said it was mostly knocking on doors and putting up yard signs. What kind of budget, how much fundraising were you able to do within the Republican Party?
Oh, man. Well, I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I think I raised like $340. Like, okay. I'm not even joking you. It's like, because we're so small and there's not that many people, like, so I'm in a flotarial seat. So I have two wards within my city. I represent probably like 6,600 people. That's tiny compared to a lot of other places, and there's 10 counties in New Hampshire, and there are potentially 400 House seats in this state. So it's like it's all pretty concentrated, and they can focus on it pretty well. So, but I really didn't get that much money for people. I think I raised like $500 maybe. And I think I spent like $340, because like I had to get all the campaign stuff. I had to get like the business cards to hand out, the rat cards, the door hangers. But like, right. That's it. Like, I really didn't do much with the money part. But the money part now is kind of what I need to kind of focus on. I'm trying to raise about $3,000 now. I have a whole new like approach to this. I didn't get to do a mailer the last time. I want to do a phone bank. I have to make some new yard signs with a new color scheme or whatever on it. And so there's a lot that kind of goes into it. And I'm trying to like call like all the people that I can together and kind of their skills and the fundraising part, because I'm not that good, honestly. Like I don't like asking people for money. I really don't. But my election campaign is such a high like not like importance for me personally, to the rest of the party, but it's important to keep my seat as a libertarian in the LPNH. And then it's got a lot of national implications, so it's really important that I really get out there and be a strong face and a strong name in the public.
Absolutely. So so it sounds like you're planning to spend almost maybe 10 times as much in your original campaign. What's your feeling on this? Like, do you think that now, because you're running as a libertarian, it's going to be that much harder? Do you know who you're going to be running against in the next election? And I guess what the, who did you run against in the first one? Was it just you and one other person? And what's it like now?
I thankfully didn't have a primary opponent. It was pretty much just me against the Democrat, and she's on the school board. So I think that was her second time as a candidate. I don't know if she's going to run again. She actually beat me in Ward 4 because they're predominantly blue, and then I won Ward 5 because they're predominantly red. So and the Ward 5 was what carried me, and I only won by about 116 votes. And that was in an election year, like a national election year. So I'm kind of anxious about my chances, and I'm hoping that my incumbency will kind of play into it. But I've also been pretty public. I've been in my paper quite a bit because like the stuff that I've done in the causes that I care about. I've made myself a public figure in this city as much as I can be. I mean, again, like we're small, but a lot of people don't really pay attention to that stuff. They just see the over-encompassing, things with Trump and stuff in Congress. So it's kind of hard for a lot of people to care or pay attention to the State House, unless, some big bill is coming through and they want to call me about it, which has happened quite a bit in the last couple of years. But my chances, It does kind of, play into who my opponent is. I did get a phone call yesterday from somebody who's very, very well known in this state as an ultra conservative. She's been in this in the House at least twice, and she asked me to run for the ward that she is in, and then she would run for my seat because she wants me to stay in office, wants to have another shot at getting back in the State House and being a conservative and getting all the votes from Ward 5. And I respect her, but I told her that it's not fair for me or for the people that want me in office to run for another seat, but I wouldn't be an incumbent, and I already have the seat that I got elected to. I'm not going to run for another seat. That doesn't make sense. So if she chooses to file against me, it's going to be really interesting. It wouldn't be a personal thing by any means. She just, it's important for her to get back and keep the Republicans happy and to keep the slim majority that they do have in the House. They're kind of in the shallow end of the pool for candidates. So they're kind of trying to get anybody that they can. But she's got some family issues going on, so I don't know if it would be wise for her to run against me. And I tried to convince her, look, like, I think you're great, and all, but, like, you're trying to get rid of somebody that's a good vote in the House because you want to get back in. But it would make more sense, for you to run against the other, person in Ward 4 that isn't a good vote and to get them out of the House. So we'll see. I really don't know. The filing period opened today, so I won't know until this week or next week who my opponents will be. I didn't get a chance to file today, but I'm hoping to tomorrow, and then I'm hoping I will find out. I'm kind of anxious about it because there's so much work to do, and I just want to know like what I'm going to be up against. So
great, awesome. That all sounds pretty good. So let's talk about like your policy and your influences a little bit. Are there anything we like to talk about taxes the most? And I think New Hampshire was actually one of the states where you had the you had this. It was a welfare bill where anybody who was on welfare, instead of the drug testing like some of the other states did, they said if you were able-bodied, you would have to go do community service or something like that. And it turned out to work out pretty well. So New Hampshire is already kind of like, figuring out some of these things really well. Are there any other tax bills that you've either introduced or worked on, or is there anything else relating to taxes that you're interested in doing?
My first year, I co-sponsored a bill to repeal the commuter's income tax. The funny thing about that bill was that it was more or less a cleanup bill because the law had already been ruled unconstitutional in like 1976. But for whatever purpose, they never got rid of the actual RSA and the statutes. So I just co-sponsored a bill to get rid of the language of the commuter's income tax in the RSAs. As far as actual tax bills, I mean, the most we talk about in this state is education taxes, the marijuana stuff. It's all kind of tied it together. So, but we see probably 1,000 to 2,000 bills every term. So, I honestly can't remember every bill that I've dealt with. off the top of my head, a lot of the bills that I've sponsored and co-sponsored have been more about the actual policy, issue stuff. Not too much about taxes, but I will say that Caleb and I have kind of argued in favor of not so much tax credits per se, but kind of in that direction to offset the costs on the business climate in this state. We have a huge rate of property taxes, and actually energy costs in New Hampshire are like insanely high. So there's a large portion of us, even in the Republican Party, that I've been trying to offset a lot of that cost burden on individuals and small and large the businesses in the state alike. So but it's been a struggle because there are a lot of people even in that party that think that the government has a role in regulating a lot of that. So those bills don't always pass, and it's been pretty frustrating. So but I honestly don't have a lot of tax bills I could think of that I've really
Someone attempted to pass an income tax, a general income tax, in New Hampshire, I think, in the last few months, right?
There's always one of those bills that comes up. I think what they wanted to do, if I remember correctly, again, I'm trying to go back through a couple thousand bills. If I remember correctly, I think they wanted to introduce an income tax to offset the oh God, what was it? Because we don't have a sales tax here either. I've been to lower the meals and rooms tax because that's at like 9% currently, which is crazy. we also have an interest in a dividends tax, which technically is an income tax. It's just not as high or traditional as
tax, sort of sounds.
Yeah,
like
something like that. We do have Oh, I know what it was. It was to introduce an income tax to offset the cost of the business enterprise and the business profits taxes. I think that's what that was. And that's usually introduced by Democrats. So,
of course,
that stuff's not going to pass because even anytime an income tax bill comes through the House, that's immediately news because we're one of the only states that doesn't currently have one. So people are like, hell no, I don't want like, oh God, this is
Yeah.
So those won't ever pass in New Hampshire. I think as long as that tradition is upheld.
Well, that's good to hear. And yeah, there are only a few states. I've been I was living in Texas for what, maybe 7 years, and they don't have an income tax. And I moved there from California, where, of course, they have a pretty high income tax, and everyone's tax strategy
on everything.
And everyone's tax strategy in California was to go incorporate in Nevada so that you would save some money on taxes. But it's there's all kinds of problems with that never never really works out the way it's supposed to. But yeah, that's really interesting. So I guess so you have some of these other policy plans. You said you worked for decriminalization of marijuana. What's the gun culture out there like?
Oh, we're very pro 2A out there. We have a lot of Second Amendment advocates in New Hampshire. We got constitutional carry to pass, which was huge. And that's something I'm extremely proud of, to be to have been a part of that. I didn't do anything with putting my name on the bill, you know, unfortunately, but I did vote in favor of it, of course, and it was a pretty big deal when that happened, because now we're actually going back to using the Constitution as the permit that it was supposed to be. I don't believe in any other arbitrary law to control the ownership or, you know, the use or the carrying of any firearms in New Hampshire. And now we don't need the permit system in New Hampshire, only if you go to another state that would honor our permit and actually increase the length of time for it to be valid from 4 years to 5 years. So we have a very strong gun culture in New Hampshire, but unfortunately you have the what about the children types that will sit there and cry foul about, you know, things that happen in other places and say, see, like, that's why we need to take your guns away. And it's like, it ain't going to happen here because people will shoot you back. it's just the nature of it. You know, we're more or less a conservative state, I guess. we're just a weird mix, because I think federally we're kind of conservative, even though, like, our congressmen are all, you know, female, Democrats. It's just so weird how things kind of play out that way. But a lot of, I would say, like, the top half of the state is all conservative. So when you start kind of, you know, coming down here, you know, to the coast and urban areas, start to get a little more liberal and, you know, they care more about gun control than gun rights, and they don't understand the natural part of, I have the right to myself, I have the right to my property, and I have the right to defend it as I see fit. People don't understand that argument. They don't understand the concept that, you know, of what a natural right is. They look at the Constitution as something that's irrelevant now, and they want to trample all over it. I see the Constitution as an acknowledgement of the natural right that I already have. So, and the our state constitution actually predates the national one, so I would more or less adhere to our state constitution over the federal one anyway, just because we go a little more in depth and we kind of outline specifically, like, more of what the state's role is in our lives in this state. I'd like to see our federal constitution kind of incorporate a little more of what our state one does, but that's a whole other, you know, conversation. So, but yes, to answer your question, we have a very strong, gun culture in New Hampshire.
No, I mean, that's all really great information. And this kind of actually leads me to ask you, because it sounds like, you know, New Hampshire, it's the live free or die state. You've got very friendly gun laws, especially now. It sounds like your taxes are relatively low, except for the property tax that you mentioned. There's a lot of freedom in this state. So I want to ask kind of, you know, about some of these things that most normal people have to deal with, like on a day to day, like, Do they like how are the police there? Are they the same as every other state where they're actively setting up speed traps and doing all that? Do you have the fake court system that a lot of states use, where it's not really a court that you're going to, and they substitute judges with either prosecutors or temporary lawyers and all this other stuff? How does that all play out up there?
Yeah. So actually, I'm proud of this. For a minute here is our state Supreme Court actually ruled that the sobriety and the immigration checkpoints that happen in the state are unconstitutional. Our state said that our police departments in the state cannot conduct these checkpoints because they infringe upon our Fourth Amendment right to not, be searched improperly. And I love that we have a very active, cop watch, community up here that is pretty active, keeping things pretty accountable up here. A group that I'm getting into now. I'm not anti-police, but a lot of what's happening in the police culture now is that you still have the nationalist types that think that the police are the heroes and they need to be protected and respected above all else. And we've kind of lost that questioning authority thing where, if a cop is wrong, he needs to know that he's wrong and not allow yourself to be bullied by him because of his badge or what he is supposed to represent. I think that the police in New Hampshire are better than a lot of places. We don't have a lot of those awful interactions that a lot of places do, but they are far from perfect, and they definitely have shot people in New Hampshire with the other person not being armed or unlawful arrests. We just had somebody from Exeter get arrested. I'm not sure if you saw this. It's been kind of going around, but somebody from Exeter, New Hampshire, got arrested because he criticized their police chief on Facebook.
Yeah.
We're getting to a point in culture where social media is bleeding out into the real life. And we have a statute that actually that came through, I think, last year, which would repeal the criminal speech impediment, the criminal would repeal the law that would allow people to say, you said something bad about me and I can sue you or have you arrested. I apologize for it. I just, yeah, thank you. Thank you. I had a hard time with, D word that time. So, I apologize again.
No worries.
So, to actually get rid of that statute, but the bill failed because people needed to keep it in place. And now that I'm hoping that with this issue being public, if that bill will come back, and we can finally pass that and not allow the police to, continue to infringe upon our rights to free speech and not to be searched without a warrant. And those things are still happening. But I will say that we have a lot of rallies and protests at the state house in this state, and the police don't really get involved. In fact, they actually protect a lot of the protesters. Not every time. I know that we had the 420 one that we do every year. I wasn't a part of it, but I know people there that were a part of it. And this, there was a state police who is stationed at the state house that tried to break it up and say, hey, if you're smoking, then get out of here, whatever. And it's been decriminalized, dude. So piss off. I don't smoke. I'm still in the National Guard, unfortunately. I've been in for almost 9 years, so I can't smoke. I have 3 years left in my contract. God, shoot me, please. I respect and would, to the end of my life, I would stick up for the right of anybody else to consume what they think is right for themselves. It's not the role of any police officer or government to say what you can and cannot indulge in. That's why I've been very prominent on the marijuana issue. I've actually talked to my police chief and say, hey, are you guys even trying to enforce any type of you know, a marijuana law. I'm in the city, and because we have a huge opioid issue in the city, like, they can't focus on pot smokers, which I'm grateful for, but we have another issue to deal with. And I've actually co-sponsored a lot of bills to you know, vamp up the medical cannabis program in this state, so we have a lot more qualifying conditions that people can apply for that. So but getting back to your other question, our police aren't that bad, but they're not great anywhere. I have a hard time believing that there's not one town or city or county that police officers aren't I don't want to use the word corrupted. They're not corrupted. They're trying to enforce laws that they claim they have no control over, and they keep blaming politicians for passing bad laws. And I would give them that, you know, sure. But you're the one who's enforcing them. You don't have to enforce a bad law. You don't have to enforce an immoral law, especially if you know if it's going to infringe on someone's constitutional rights. So to that end, if they knowingly enforce a law that is going to violate someone's rights, then that person should not be a police officer. I don't know if that's bold to say that or not, but I think that's kind of a fact where, people are so obsessed with, the police and the military, they've held them up to a higher standard. But then if you criticize them for things that they do wrong, it's like you're the heretic, but they can't see outside the box. And that's like the one frustrating thing of trying to educate people on. It's like, these people are people, and if they do something wrong, they should be held accountable to it. I think across our whole country, we're seeing a culture of police officers not being accountable for their actions, and it's just stirring up more hate and frustration. And now we're starting to see that in the age of social media, where people can take videos and pictures now, and it's a really weird time to be in now. So,
yeah, that's actually interesting, because there was a guy that I knew, like, maybe 20 years ago and 15 years ago, and his mother was a police officer, and this guy was always like shoplifting and doing little petty things, and he would get arrested for it, and he would always get off because his mom was a cop, and she just went and talked to the right people. And it's kind of like what you're saying, where there's like this kind of apologist thing going on, like, they're human, mm-hmm. and they make mistakes,
absolutely.
But because they're police, we let them off. And what's actually really scary about this story is this guy that I knew, I found out a couple years ago that he was breaking into someone's house one day and abducted like a 13-year-old girl and did all kinds of really awful things. And they finally caught him for this. And like everyone in this made like news, like all around the city, all around the state even. And everyone was like, how could this happen? Why do people think they can get away with this stuff? And the answer is obvious if you look into the history, which I don't know why this was never brought up in the media. Maybe no one knew about it. But it's because he knows he can get away with this stuff. I mean, this guy, I remember like the last time I talked to him, he had just been arrested because he stole a car and there was someone sleeping in the back seat that he supposedly didn't know was back there. And I'm mm-hmm. sure he got off from that too, because he was released to go do this other thing a couple of years later. And it's like it's obvious when you look at that. He started out doing small things. He got arrested because his mom was a cop, and you have that whole, oh, he's the family of a police officer. He's a good kid. Let him go. And it just gets into the cycle, and they start doing worse and worse. And if you apply that to police, and they think, oh, well, I illegally searched that guy's car, and, the worst that happened to me is that I couldn't prosecute him because the evidence wasn't admitted. But every other, the 10 other illegal searches I did, they weren't able to prove they were illegal, so I got away with it. You kind of, you're almost encouraging it. You're letting it happen. There's no consequences, and things just kind of get worse over time. So I think you're dead on with that. And it is a little bit bold to say that, because I know there are a lot of people who are offended that, but for that same reason you just said, they see the badge and they give them a free pass. And like you said, they're human, and we need, when a human makes a mistake, police officer or not, it needs to be corrected, or else it's going to continue and possibly get worse.
It's that whole culture of the whole, thin blue line thing, and a lot of people know this about me. I talked about it. Is I used to be a corrections officer. I worked for a county jail for almost 3 years, and I kind of saw behind the scenes of kind of how that whole process works, and it's always bothered me that, you know, people are coming in for non-crimes, even like the whole, you know, possession of drugs and everything. Like, they're not real crimes. Like, but anyway, can't get into that. That's like a whole policy issue that I'll talk about if you ask me about it. But I would get frustrated with the way that the police would treat people. And I understand that they deal with, you know, they do deal with some crappy people. And I totally get that. I had to deal with a lot of crappy people being a corrections officer, because these cops would bring them in and then I have to deal with them after the fact. So it's, you know, that they don't care because they get to leave after. And I had people that would be very combative and they'd be drunk or high or whatever. But they all kind of protect each other. And when I was going, through the academy, they would tell us like all these, you know, horror stories of what happened to CEOs in some places and whatnot. And, you know, back in my head, I'm thinking, well, what about how you know, the way that the inmates got treated? Like, they're human beings. They're not cattle. They're not like scum of the earth unless they've, you know, committed an actual crime. But, you know, again, that goes back to bad laws being in place and the cops having to enforce them. So a lot of people that are in jail that, you know, shouldn't be in jail are there because the police thing that they have to enforce a law, no matter how crappy it is, and there are some police that will admit it's a shitty law, but we have to enforce it, or I get in trouble, or I get fired, or whatnot. So that's a huge frustration for me. Like, if there's so much discretion in how you conduct, you know, yourself in the public, why aren't you using it? You know, but that's like a big contention for me is. You know, trying to break up the monopoly of you know, cover-ups and we're going to protect our own, you know, the us against them thing. I can't stand that kind of mentality. And until you can see the humanity, you know, beyond, you know, some of the things that you don't like about people or how you even get treated by some people, at the end of the day, like, you know, at that moment, you're in control of that person's life, and there is a lot at stake with how you conduct yourself going forward. I mean, you can make that person's life worse than it might be, or if you cut them a break and they somehow turn their life around, like, they could owe that to you, you know. So, but we can't put a blanket statement on every situation. We're just not there every time, and I certainly am not. So. But our court system is a whole other thing. Like, yeah. I didn't want to get into our court system because that I actually have more frustration with our courts than any other group of people that are in our you know, criminal justice system. And I got a bachelor's degree in this field because I believe wholeheartedly that we need widespread you know change and reforms all across the board. And that's why I want to get into public policy.
Because I mean, because, you know, especially when you hear about these cases where, you know, you've got so many people who sympathize with the police, and then they're just like, you know, oh, well, if you would just follow their orders, you'll have your day in court and all this other stuff. And then, of course, you get your day in court and you kind of get screwed there, too. So what's going on in New Hampshire, and what do you see that's going on that's wrong that needs to be changed?
There's been this big claim or sightings of corrupted judges, and you know that goes to the court issue where you know there's just that political power because they're all appointed in the state, they're not elected, so they all kind of feel like that they're protected by upper government and they conduct themselves in a not so favorable light. There's a way that, like, there's a huge process to get them off the bench, And unfortunately, as far as the legislature, we have to pass a bill to do that. And that's a crappy way to do it. But that's why a lot of people get frustrated. And I've gotten hounded by people asking me, like, you know, what are you going to do about this, this and that? Like, I only have so much control. I'm one guy. Like, I don't even hold an office that has any power in this state. I'm honestly just a guy that goes to the state house and I vote on bills. I introduce bills on issues that I care about, and I can't do much about the stuff that the judicial branch is doing. But that is a huge frustration with a lot of people, and I think that I wish we had a better climate for people to obtain a lawyer. A lot of people do pro bono stuff, the public defender's offices and whatnot. But when I was a CO, and I was dealing with the county court systems and whatnot, like, these people are severely overworked. There's not enough. There's not enough candidates to get people in these positions, and they work for crap money and they work for crap clients, and it's just. I honestly don't know what the answer is. I'm trying to figure that out as I navigate my way through this public policy. That's actually why I want to get my master's degree in this field as well, because in public policy, because I want to be an expert in this field. I want to have solutions, and as long as I'm a public figure, as someone who's elected to an office that can affect, change in the legislature, I want to be able to work on that. So. I wish I had more answers for you as far as as an outright plan, but I'm learning as I go. I'm in my first term. I don't know all the answers yet. So, but when I do, I'll start promoting that for sure.
This is interesting, and I'll actually. So before I got involved with Taxation and Theft, I had another site called Accountable Authority, which was actually, when all the police videos started getting uploaded, I don't know how many years ago. And it was supposed to be like a database, and I actually ended up creating like a sort of a law on there that, or like a bill that I wanted to propose. So maybe you can look at that and get some ideas for some types of things like that. But there's, it's the things that like a lot of states are doing now, where like there's mandatory body cams and stuff like that. But when we're talking about the courts, go ahead.
Yeah, we had a body cam bill come through, and I don't think it passed. I think. I don't remember what the reasoning was. I think Caleb actually sponsored that bill. I don't remember why it was killed, because it was killed a year ago, so I don't remember. Like, body cams, like, the most simplest of solutions, right, to make, police accountability like more prevalent, and we can't even get that done. That's kind of the problem when you have so many people in office that have so many opinions on things, that there's no like real solid consensus as to like where do we stand on this issue. It's all kind of on the individual. I mean, the Democrats actually vote like more or less as a voting block. They're all kind of like in lockstep together, so they're not reliable to get an actual clear stance on an issue, because if they stray from the pack, they get pounded in like into dust in the media or in house, so it's kind of pathetic in my views. But
it's one of those things where you need to keep reintroducing it, because that's what they do. Yeah. Like with the income tax bill, they're going to keep reintroducing it until they hope one day it passes. And if you can kind of, keep reintroducing eventually, because it's the thing. I was just watching a video about why pop music is so terrible, but everybody loves it, because it's repetition. Once you hear it seven or eight times, it's like you are. Unconsciously being forced to like it. And so if you keep submitting the bill, like, I think eventually, it's people are they're going to be more aware of it. They're going to learn about it each time. Like, maybe they'll just learn one benefit each time it's reintroduced. And, it just has to, just keep retrying. But something else that you said that was.
Yeah, I don't think the issue is dead yet.
Go ahead.
Oh no, I apologize. There's kind of a lag here. I said that. We're not going to give up on the issue. That there are a lot of people that care, and we're still fighting the civil asset forfeiture thing, and we've scaled it back some. We've had some victories there, but as long as that statute exists in the first place, it's still infringing on the liberty of others. So That's an issue that I've dealt with. I put in a bill on that. And we also are trying to do jury denullification bill, and that's been a national issue as well. Excuse me. And we're making headway on it, but I think what happens is that it always like passes in the House and then it fails in the Senate. So you know, again, it's the unreliability of the Senate when it's 400 state representatives and then 24 senators. So there's a huge gap there that it's hard to kind of get some good stuff through because they don't want to vote on it. But
so
yes,
this nullification bill?
It was just as it says. I mean, it was a way to put it in the statutes that when somebody has a jury trial that they will be aware that they're able to rule on the scope of the law, not just on the actual like crime itself. So if the law is unjust, the jury has a right to rule on that law as it applies to the the case. I don't have the bill in front of me, but the language was trying to put more of the onus on the jury instead of at a single person.
Right. I'm just really interested in that because from what I understand, there's Supreme Court rulings that say a juror cannot be punished for saying not guilty, regardless of no matter how obvious this guy violated this statute. Mm-hmm. But I've also heard of lawyers being disbarred or charged with contempt of court for trying to explain anything about jury nullification to a jury. So I'm wondering, is this more like saying that like the lawyers are going to be allowed to argue that to the jury, or is that going to have to be part of the judge's orders to the jury, or is it just kind of legalizing it the way that it is, but not necessarily creating any power to it?
I don't know who specifically would be the one informing it, but a jury would be informed as to the applicability of the law. I think I wish I was prepared
to look that up,
but
as long as the jury's able to know, because I know right now in Texas, Sean Jones is he's always out there handing out his jury instruction pamphlets outside the court, and he gets harassed by the police, and basically it's about jury nullification. He's getting harassed by the police for giving out legal, like, First Amendment violation, so that's really interesting, but it's whatever this statute is, I'd like to read more up on it, but it sounds really awesome.
I'm going to send you, I will send you a link to the bill that we just had, because it was the same bill that came back. Because we've had it twice now, I think, since I've been here. So I'll just send you a link to the bill and you can check it out, because I don't I remember all the language in it. But I think that you would find, it is a good bill, but it's the underlying issue that people might have a problem with. They want the judicial system to focus on prosecuting the crime and not, I'm curious to have peace to the rightness of a law as the way that it's applied in the court system. So I will send you a link to that after we're done.
Okay, cool. Another question I had for you, I guess this would be kind of more like a hypothetical, or just to get your opinion on it, because you mentioned, and I've seen this before too, you usually have prosecutors who are not too, or I guess usually paid a lot more than the public defenders, and then you have the public defenders who there's only a couple of them, and they're they've got like 10 cases for every one the prosecutor has, and I'm interested to know, like, what do you think about some sort of a system where the public defenders are required to be paid just as much as a prosecutor, or to make sure that when the public defenders are hired, there's always the same number hired as there are of prosecutors. So that basically, you know, whoever's doing the hiring basically says, okay, we've got 100 prosecutors and 2 public defenders. We can't hire any more prosecutors until we get more public defenders. You know, something like that to kind of balance it out.
Yeah, I've never heard that. Like we elect our county attorneys, so the county attorney is an elected position, and they're the prosecutor, and, you know, of the county for the county court system. So I don't know how it is anywhere else. I really can't speak to that.
I mean, that's usually kind of the thing. You elect a district attorney or a county attorney, but then they hire deputy attorneys to basically handle all their cases, because it's not one, you know,
yeah,
one lawyer that's going to handle all the cases. So they hire their deputies, and sometimes the district attorney is the one who hires the public defenders, because it's their obligation. Oh, we want to try this guy. We have to hire a lawyer for him. And so, you know, there's that kind of thing. But it just seems to me like if I'm a lawyer and I'm fresh out of law school and I'm like, hey, I want to make some money, and I look at it and I see, let's see, public defender is getting paid, you know, $5,000 a year, but I can go work as a prosecutor for $80,000. It's kind of a no-brainer. So, you know, it's I think that would be an interesting comparison. But like I said, I don't know any of the statistics of where those numbers actually are right now. But you kind of gave me the thought to go look it up and see, you know, see what there is to be done there.
Well, we just had a vote of the county last year, or not last year, sorry, last Friday, on the actual elected official salaries, the part-time and the full-time people, which was like, oh my God, like mind-numbing, because everyone's arguing about the merits of trying to raise a salary or not to raise a salary. I was in the position of not trying to raise those salaries because do the taxpayers know that they're paying for this stuff, and like the benefit packages? It was a huge rage thing. And I posted a video from my own personal page because I was like on a rant, and I was like, I'm not going to put this on my rep page because I'm just too heated right now. But essentially, the county attorney for Stratford County makes $91,000 a year. And people were trying to make the argument that that's not enough money to incentivize people to run for that position or to keep that position. And I'm of the mind going, like, are you effing kidding me? Like, if you're going to run for office, of any office, any political position, in any part of your state, your county, your of whatever, if you're doing it for financial purposes only, you should never, ever, ever get elected to that position. Our yeah, political job's not about making money off the backs of taxpayers. Our job is to protect the rights of the people and to keep government in check. And if you're going to use that position to make a dollar, get the hell out. And I will say this to anybody's face. You do not belong in any position of any kind of power if you're doing it for, you know, for financial incentives. I get really angry about that because we make $100 a year per our state constitution for being reps. And even our state senators are paid $100 a year. I don't do this for the money. Are you kidding me? I do it because I'm somebody in office that's trying to protect the liberty of others. I'm trying to keep the state government from enacting stupid and unenforceable laws that are either going to spend too much money or that are impossible to enforce or that are just plain out, you know, like infringing on someone's rights. And for someone in the Stratford County, you know, delegation to try to make the argument that these people don't make enough money to stay in their positions is absolutely asinine to me. So that's all I'm going to say about that. I'll tell that to anybody who's running for any political office in this country, in the Libertarian Party. If you're doing it for financial gain, do not run for office.
Nice. I like it.
I'm off my soapbox, sorry.
No, that's actually really good to hear. And you know, what a lot of people don't realize, you know, like, so even when we look at the federal level, the representatives are making, I think, like 200 and something grand per year. President's making like 400 grand per year. Once they serve for, I think, 2 terms, they get that for the rest of their life. And president, maybe just 1 term, whatever it is. They're making, that's a lot of money. And then you take into the to account that they're not full time. I mean, well, unless you include like lobbying and all that other crap, which is usually paid for by someone else, they're not full time jobs. They're not working the whole time. And people think that like, oh, they need all this money and you know, and it's like, wait a minute. Look, if you look back to the beginning of the United States, these guys were paid like they were paid like a per diem for the few days out of the year that they went to Congress to meet and vote on bills. They didn't have salaries. When they did have salaries, it was so small, it was like it was nothing. And you know, just like you said, these people weren't doing that for the money. They would go back home, they'd practice their law, they'd run their businesses, you know, in their home states. And that's not what this was about. This was not intended to be a full-time job where you don't have any other business to run. This is just all you do. You're a career politician. And so I think that's really interesting to point out. And, you know, so it sounds like even in your state, your annual pay is still really low. And of course, I'm sure you still have some representatives who are making plenty of money on the sides from lobbyists and whatnot.
So I will point out something is that we do get 53 cents a mile. That's a federal rate for travel to and from session days or when you're working in committee. So I make $100 a year, and then I make like $38 a month in mileage, like, you know, payments. And come on, like, really? That's like maybe gas for a day or whatever. But like, I already got paid for my full term, like, the first month after I got elected. So I haven't made my $100 a year since I got elected. It's kind of funny how that'll – and, it is a kind of a long joke that because, you know, we don't get paid for this job. But I will say the makeup of the House is directly correlated to the pay and the time commitment. So – a lot of people that get elected are either already independently, you know, financially well off, or they are retired, and in some cases even unemployed. The first 2.5 to 3 months of 2018, I was unemployed. I didn't have my job anymore, and I was in the search for a new full-time job. But in the meantime, I was able to do all of my committee work. I was able to make every session, and to me, that's really important. But for a lot of people in my age and younger, that kind of time commitment to, you know, 2 to 3 days a week is a lot for unpaid position. So right. That's why it's really hard to get people that are even 45 and younger to run, because everybody still has to work. Like, and then people have the balls to give me crap for not being able to make a session day, and I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, I've got a wife and 2 kids to worry about. Like, really, I've got bills to pay. I've got car payment, rent. Like, you're not gonna make me feel bad during the one session day.
It's not like you were on the golf course, right?
No, like I gotta provide for my family. Like, don't give me shit for not being able to make a vote that you care about. Like, I care about that vote too, but I can't make every session. So we're trying to change the dynamic. And the demographics, the people that are able to run for office. And I fortunately was in a great position when I come home from deployment and started a campaign 6 months after that to be able to run a campaign, because I was on a certain work schedule that kind of worked out. So it was awesome. But this time around, like, I got a new full-time job. I've been back to work about 3 months now, which has been awesome. But I'm trying to catch up on bills and everything still. But what's really great is I'm pretty sure that my boss is a constituent of mine. So I didn't know when I started. We kind of figured that out like a little bit after I started. And he's been like super awesome about allowing me to go whenever I need to go take care of stuff with the state house or even like get my kid from school if her mother isn't able to. So right now I'm in a great position to campaign. I'm in a great position to keep doing what I'm doing. And I've actually I plan to announce this when I put out a letter to the editor to my paper, kind of announcing my campaign for re-election, that I'm putting a self-imposed term limit on my involvement in state government. I will run for this last term, and then I'm going to bow out. So after when the 2020 election comes around, I'll figure out my political future from then. But I only want to run and serve in 2 terms and then take myself out of it to let somebody else kind of take over the reins. My family would like to move, at some point. My kids are getting older. My daughter is 9 and my stepson just turned 11 about 2 weeks ago. So we got to, kind of figure out our own future. And so I think one more term is good, and then I'm going to kind of take myself out of the game. So, but that point, we'll kind of see like what my involvement is in the party. If I run for, a position in the party, or if I run for higher office in the state somewhere. But for now, I'm going to run for another seat, and then I'm going to bow out.
Cool.
Awesome. Or another term.
That sounds great. And I mean, it really sounds, I'm glad I got to talk to you. It sounds like you're doing some really awesome things. I think it sounds like most of your, I haven't heard anything that I disagree with out of you. So that's pretty awesome. And I can't wait to see what you do in the future. Hopefully we'll talk sometime in the future. We'll have you on again and good luck with the next election.
Well, yes. Thank you very much for allowing me to come on. And if I can for a second, I'd like to just kind of, allow people to have a chance to get involved in my campaign. You can go to finneynh.com, which is it's been up since last July. I have a donation link in there. Anything that you want to kind of throw my way, so I can, for all the things that I need to get to as many people as possible. Follow me on Facebook. You can follow my rep page at Facebook. .com/Finney for state rep, and then I'm on Twitter at @RepBFinneyNH. Just kind of putting myself out there because Twitter's actually been a really good platform for me to use, because it's kind of in like real time, so I've been able to connect to a lot of people that way. So I'm glad to be on those platforms. Please follow me and share, like, whatever. I'll talk to you guys soon. So I appreciate you, and I will. I'm going to send you a link to that bill, so don't let me forget.
Cool. And I'll go ahead and put all your links. I'll put all those links that you just mentioned on the video also. So if you're watching the video,
Great.
Look for the links and you can click them. And I just have one more question for you. What is taxation?
Yeah, taxation is absolute theft.
Awesome. All right. Thanks again, and we'll see you later. Thanks for watching, guys. Remember to like and share the video, and we'll see you next time.
Have a great night.